Today's episode is sponsored by Tego. For most of us, indemnity insurance is one of our biggest costs of practice. But when was the last time you took a look at the coverage and compared your premium with others?
Many of us are still with the same insurer we joined in med school or intern year. Thousands of doctors have made the switch to Tego and benefited from their personalized approach to pricing. You will also get an extra 2 months free in your first year.
If you are new to private practice, you might even qualify for 4 years of discounted premiums.
Tego offers competitive premiums, quality cover and 24/7 support backed by top medico-legal advisors.
Get a free quote and discover why thousands of doctors are insured by Tego by visiting tego.com.au. Hello listeners and welcome to Deep Breaths, a podcast covering topics related to the Part 2 anaesthetic exam. I'm Dr. Kate McCrossan.
And I'm Dr. Kate Steele. And today's episode is Eye of the Tiger Part 1. Where we'll discuss anaesthesia for eye surgery with special guest Dr. Lahiru Amratunga. In this podcast, we represent our own views and not those of our employers or ANZCA.
Dr. Lahiru Amratunga is a consultant anaesthetist working full-time in public practice. He's a SIM and ALS instructor and does a lot of private eyes for a bit of fun. He has a great interest in teaching and is the mastermind behind the Viva Bootcamp for registrars preparing to sit the Part 2 exam, the YouTube channel ABCs of Anaesthesia, and a co-host of the podcast Anaesthesia Coffee Break, geared at helping basic anaesthetic trainees pass the Part 1 exam. That is a lot of teaching. Well done. Lahiru loves travel and is an all-round nice guy. Lahiru, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks very much for having us. And you know what? I've recently just started uploading short videos on TikTok, and that place is wild, I've got to say. I've never had people so confident in like criticizing and trolling me. Like, you know, you get a few comments in YouTube and stuff, but this is just 24/7 of incredible trolling.
It's so really interesting.
If you want to laugh, have a read the comments.
Awesome. That's hilarious. We'll have to talk about that more later. So look, Lahiru, we thought we'd get you to discuss a couple of case scenarios to really cover as much as we can regarding anaesthesia for eye surgery. And I wanted to start with some straightforward elective scenarios to really get the conversation flowing, and particularly since elective surgery forms the bulk of the eye procedures presenting to the operating theatres.
So look, our first case is a 71-year-old female patient presenting on your list for an elective left cataract surgery. She weighs 75 kilograms and has a BMI of 28. She has mild ischemic heart disease, hypertension and hypercholesterolemia, all of which are medically managed and clinically stable. She is otherwise well, but is very anxious at the thought of having awake eye surgery. What is your approach to this sort of situation, and is there anything specific you include when assessing patients like this?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it probably happens probably once a list. So I do probably, you know, 10 to 30 eye anaesthesia for eye cataracts, you know, on any given week, and maybe one to two of those patients every week will be super anxious. And I've got to say, all it takes, in my experience, is giving them a little bit more sedation, reassurance, you know, maybe getting into theatre and holding their hands, saying it's going to be okay, and extremely rarely running propofol at 5 mL/hour. Like, that's literally the progress that I'll do. And you know, there's definitely, like, you know, when you're going through your training, there's definitely a lot of things that are said about, you know, if they're super anxious, you've got to do a GA. I just know that it's such a quick procedure with a good surgeon who's a quick surgeon and a great team. You can almost do everything just with a block and minimal sedation, no matter how anxious they are. And very, 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 very rarely, maybe in the last 2 years, I've done 2 GAs for a super anxious patient, but with also psychiatric disorders. So, yeah. I think very little contraindicates doing an eye operation and an eye operation with topical or a block.
And I think that's a good point you raise as well, is that, you know, anaesthesia is not just about giving medication to calm people down. You can actually change your behaviour and do certain sort of things that are a bit more human, like holding their hand and talking to them about their grandchildren or whatever interests them. And often that can get them through, you know, what... Yes, you could do a general anaesthetic, but or you can make life easy for yourself. And yes, it's a bit more labor intense, but at the end of the day, it's better for the patient. So it's a good learning point. Thanks for reminding us.
Yeah, and I mean, this probably is the, like, all the other scenarios we'll cover are extremely rare. You know, you don't, if you're not in an eye hospital, you're probably not going to be seeing a lot of these other kind of complex patients having complex eye surgery. So really, if you can deal with the situation of an anxious patient having a cataract, that's pretty much all your problems sorted out in the eye anesthesia world. And yeah, I've got to say, you know what you're worried about? You're worried about the patient suddenly just going, yep, no, this is not happening, or, you know, putting their arms up. Like, there's all these little things, like in practice, and this may not be the exam answer, but, you know, just tucking the arms into the blankets so that when, if they do feel like moving, if they may be a bit over sedated or whatever, the surgeon gets a bit of a warning. Or again, just being there instead of being in the other room blocking, you're there, just there going, you know what, I'm just going to be here. As soon as I see movement of the arms, boom, hands on. And a whole 5 mils an hour peripheral, you know, obviously you wouldn't do it in lots of different situations. If they're a fasted patient, you'd be okay with doing it. But, you know, unfasted, which happens occasionally with cataract operations, you probably wouldn't want to be running peripheral. And I mean, five mils an hour is just nothing but enough to keep them, keep them comfortable and happy.
Mm. Yeah, I like it. So can you walk us through how you would perform a subtenon's block?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got to say, just to go through a bit of anatomy, I think that's probably good for this whole topic. Like, you know,
yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, anatomy, think of the orbit, the globe and the layers of the globe and the nerves and the muscles and maybe the vessels, broadly speaking. Just quickly with the orbit, you know, it's a pyramidal shape. There's a base at the front of the skull. The apex points posterior medially. The contents are literally, you've got the globe, you've got the extraocular muscles, you've got some nerves, you've got some vessels, and then the optic foramen sits at the apex of that pyramid and transmits that optic nerve and the central retinal artery and vein. Now, the layers of the globe, and this definitely relates to the subtenon's block, so deep to superficial, you've got your sclera, which is the vascular that completely surrounds the globe except over the cornea at the front. Then there's a subtenon space, deep subtenon space, which is a potential space. You've got the tenon's capsule, which is white and avascular, and then the conjunctiva overlying that. You know that the cornea covers the iris, and the conjunctiva covers the eye, except where it's covered by the cornea. And then that limbus is really that junction between the sclera and the cornea. So a whole bunch of things. Rewind that, you know, 30 seconds, skip back if you need to just refresh that. But sclera, subtenon space, tenon's capsule, and conjunctiva. And you've got the nerves. So, you know, you'll often refer to extracoronal and intracoronal nerves. So within the extraocular muscle cone, you've got your cranial nerves 2, the optic nerve, your ocular motor, which is cranial nerve 3, abducens, which is 6, and the nasociliary branch of V1. That would be one of your sensory nerves in the trigeminal cranial nerve. Outside the cone is cranial nerve 4, which is trochlear nerve. You've got your lacrimal branch of V1 and frontal branch of V1 and infraorbital branch of V2. And importantly, sensory supply is by the trigeminal, you know, nerve via its frontal, lacrimal, and nasociliary branches, and V2 via that infraorbital nerve. So a bit of a complex sensory supply. I've got to say, does this matter to me in actual practice? Very little if I'm doing a subtenon's block. Just make sure you get in the right space and put 3 mils in, and it'll work virtually in the first, you know, in a couple of minutes.
So what nerves are you actually anaesthetizing with the subtenon's block?
It gives total akinesia. So all of your motor nerves. Okay. And it gives all your sensory nerves that will supply the surface of the eye. Mm. They're all done as well. And to think that you don't really need much. I mean, I suspect that you don't even need to be blocking nerves to, you know, if you know you can do a whole case just with topical, just by having a leak of your 2% lignocaine with hyalase, you're probably sorting out the surface of the eye anyway. So there's very little that's needed.
Okay.
I've interrupted you, La. You were talking about anatomy.
No, I don't think it's worth too much going into all the muscles. You know, there's a whole bunch of muscles that, you know, move the eye. You know, maybe the one that's hardest to block, the one that's, you know, present outside the cone, is cranial nerve 4. That's the superior oblique. Maybe that is a bit hard to block. But again, in my experience, when I'm doing a subtenon's, everything gets blocked. And if I'm doing a peribulbar, the medial side, the medial rectus is the one that isn't blocked. So I'm not really, you know, getting, you can literally just go anatomically, you know, the things you're not going to be blocking are things that are further away from your local anesthetic point. But subtenons covers everything very, very well.
And lastly, are there any blood vessels we should be aware of when we're performing a subtenons?
Yes, the arterial supply is via the ophthalmic artery, which is a branch of the internal carotid, venous drainage via the superior and inferior ophthalmic veins. And just to know that the supramedial region, that is the most vascular area, and that's kind of where the trajectory of the optic artery is, from the apex, from the optic chiasm. And really, the because the globe is situated kind of super immediately, there's a lot of, I guess, potential space or more space in the infralateral quadrant. And that's often where we'll go in with a peribulbar block because there is more space there.
Okay, cool. Thank you so much for covering that. That's great.
Okay, so in terms of performing the subtenons block, what is your strategy there? And are there any contraindications as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's go with contraindications first. So usual thing, patient refusal. If there's any kind of infection, they, you're not going to be wanting to put any foreign bodies like a cataract lens in there anyway, so you wouldn't want to do that. You know, having a scleral block hole, which is a treatment for retinal detachment, means you probably can't get around the space that effectively, so that would be kind of a relative contraindication as well. And so those are pretty much your contraindications. If someone's on anticoagulants, I am very happy with blocking. So really, there's not too many contraindications. This is probably one of the reasons I really like the subtenons as a technique. It's definitely my preferred technique. I do with all my surgeons virtually every single time. And it's because I don't have to check axial lengths like I do in a peribulbar or retrobulbar, and I don't have to check really for anticoagulation. So in a very fast-paced list where I'm already checking lots and lots of things constantly, there's extra things that when you think about the process of an orthoptist having to transcribe a piece of data and other information and for me to check it, it's a lot of extra steps that I feel it really is unnecessary if you just do a subtenons. Now, look, I've got a whole video on my YouTube channel about how to do a subtenons, and there's a great video from the Royal Victorian Eye and Ear Hospital. I think this anaesthetist called David Oliver has put one up, and that's one of the ones I looked at. Really great graphics on that. So there's a couple of videos. Have a look at it. Yeah, I get my
sorry. And actually, just to interrupt, sorry, Lart, we will actually put links to those in our show notes, so be sure to check them out.
Awesome, awesome. So really, you know, with all the usual kind of monitoring, assistance, drugs, equipment. So, I mean, let's go from the very start. I've taken the history of my patient. Essentially, I'm checking that they can lie flat, lie still. They don't have any obvious contraindications. I put full monitoring on my patients in the operation for sure, and often it's blood pressure, SATS probe, and some oxygen. I give them anywhere from 50 to 75 of fentanyl and maybe 1 to 2 of midazolam, depending on age and other comorbidities. And then I got oxybupricaine drops in the eye. I use aqueous betadine solution in the eye and around the eye. And then I've got my solution. Really, it's in a 5 mL syringe with a subtenons cannula. I'm standing, depending on which eye it is, I'm either standing at the head or on the left of the side of the patient. And inframedial quadrant, probably about 5 to 7 mm from the limbus, I pick up with the forceps. I then make a very small incision. At that point, what I was taught before was to dilate with the scissors, with the Westcott blunt scissors that you get. But these days, I might just poke inside just to make sure I've got a space there. So I'll literally go in like 2 mm with that at most, or not at all. And I'll go straight in with my subtenons cannula, really cover the face of the eye. So when you start off, and again, check the videos, but you're really being very flat with that curved cannula, and then you go to a vertical plane. Often the problems you get is difficulty in infiltrating because you need to get a bit of space there. So what I might do is I might lift up the globe and then try to inject as I go. And then you just feel this a bit of a give. And that's when you're kind of in the space. Common things that get a bit of conjunctival swelling at that point. I don't worry too much about that. A bit of pressure gets rid of all of that really, really well. And that's about it. I've put 3 mL of solution. The solution I've kind of come to, the most minimal solution for me is 2% lignocaine with 30 units per mil of hyalase. But there's lots of other formulas of using 0.6 ropivacaine with 2% lignocaine and hyalase, or 0.4% bupivacaine with 2% lignocaine and hyalase. I found that this one, I just use the least stuff possible. If I'm not using hyalase, I realize that the block is just too slow for a fast list. Yeah, so I think like lignocaine and hyalase, that's the absolute bare minimum.
Yeah, you make an interesting point about the dissection with the scissors, because the subtenons cannula was kind of designed to do that dissection, wasn't it? So just using the scissors, as you say, the scissors to open up that potential space a little bit and make sure you're not sort of just halfway through the conjunctiva or creating a new space is, and then letting the cannula do what it was designed for, I guess.
And I'm trying to do as little movement as possible. The more things I do, the more bleeding there's going to be, and the more my surgeons are not going to like the cosmetic effect. And I really want to be doing this for 30 years with no globe ruptures, no retrobulbar hemorrhages. And I know that if I'm sticking needles in, even though it's incredibly safe to do these blocks, these needle blocks, you just can't predict what anatomy is going on there. So I want to make sure my cosmetic effect is as good as it is now so that surgeons never complain about it.
So can you just explain about a hyalase or hyaluronidase and what it's actually, what it is and what it's used for in, you know, because it's really the only time we see it in blocks is in eye blocks. I do a lot of regional anesthesia. We don't tend to use it in our regional blocks.
I wonder why we don't. It's such a big player in terms of speed of onset. But I've never actually practiced with it in regional either. So anyway, maybe something to look up. So it's hyaluronidase, and you know it comes in a vial, 1,500 units. You know, you reconstitute in many ways to get an appropriate dilution, and roughly you're using anywhere from 15 to 30 units per mil. And it's thought to hydrolyze the glycosidic bonds within hyaluronic acid, which forms the interstitial barrier and binds the cells together. So it just really allows local anesthetic to distribute, you know, from the site of injection and increase the speed of onset. Just, it, you know, it's breaking down, I guess, planes to allow local anesthetic to diffuse well. It is incredibly expensive and it can cause allergic reactions. Again, never seen it happen. And in all the hospitals I've worked at, we've never had an M&M of an allergic reaction. So, you know, incredibly low allergenicity, if anything. And, you know, the one contentious thing is that, you know, there's definitely a thing of having one vial or one medication per patient. And this goes against that as a standard. But I think that standard for all situations just doesn't make sense. Like, if you're using this, what I think is an essential element, and trying to divide up 1,500 units into appropriate quantities for multiple patients with different vials, that's far more dangerous to me than just having an appropriate sterile prep and, you know, dividing it as you go.
Do you use any other additives at all to your blocks?
No, and I've never seen the need for it. I work with some incredibly fast surgeons, and these surgeons, literally as my block goes in, the last patient is done. And once I wheel the patient in, the subtenon blocks work with a 2% ligament cannulose solution. So I've never, ever seen nor felt the need to give sodium bicarb, you know, decrease acidity, therefore increase unionized fraction of local anesthetics. That's never been a thing I've needed to do. And I've never needed to give adrenaline. Like, the surgery isn't ever going long enough that that's a problem. So, you know, so give adrenaline, vasoconstrict, stop diffusion away. That's never been a thing for me either. And, I don't know if you guys use the dexamethasone clonidine for regional blocks. I've just never felt the need to do that. So, yeah, I mean, did you have any experience with those other agents as well?
In eyes or in regional anesthesia in general?
In eyes?
Oh, I don't really do eyes, love.
No.
You know, I often joke I block most things, but I don't block eyes. Look, I did a little bit of upskilling. Gosh, it must be a couple of years ago I did a list, because I think we're running a little bit short on people that are confident doing eye blocks. But I just was never required, and I've lost my confidence with them again. What I've seen with my colleagues is, as you describe, it's some mix of either short-acting and long-acting local anesthetic with some hyalase, and I haven't seen much else in terms of adjuncts either. So, yeah.
And it does get confusing. So if you're a trainee and you're about to do an eye list, I made a video on how to drop the 2% lignocaine plus hyalase solutions. That might be one to watch. Just search the channel. There's an ophthalmic playlist on ABC's Anesthesia YouTube channel, and it's got a few of these things. But yeah, just ask your consultant what they do, because, you know, there's just so many ways you can mix and match these various local anesthetic combinations and hyalase.
Yeah, I remember as a trainee, everyone had their own little eye recipe, and so you just had to learn what their recipe was and what concentration of hyalase they wanted to use, and then you just kind of memorized it for that list, right? So, yeah.
For the exam, just pick one and just have that sort of thing.
Yeah. And I think particularly when it comes to the exam, as long as you can justify why you're using X, Y, Z, whatever, that seems to be the main thing. Just pick whatever you're going to do, stick with it, but justify why you're making that choice. Explain yourself if they ask, and you will be fine.
Yep.
So we've managed to perform the regional block without any issue, but our patient is still very anxious about having surgery awake. How would you sedate this patient?
Yeah, so my approach really is kind of what I outlined before. I mean, absolutely stop, clarify the issue. Often it's just them feeling sensation and being a bit worried about it, but, you know, to feel actual nociception with a subtenon block is just so unlikely. I just give a bit more fentanyl, give them a bit more midazolam. And, you know, even like, so occasionally I'll get a patient who the default is topical, and I'll just say, hey, just let me put a subtenons in. So either the surgeon does it, or I just redrape, put the subtenons in, and it, you know, seriously, it acts within a couple of minutes. So, you know, that's absolutely doable. And then, you know, running a small trickle of propofol, I think it's really safe being there, hand-holding, tucking the arms in, taping the head is something we do as well occasionally with patients. Mm. Some surgeons do, some surgeons don't. And finally, you know, there's only one time, and this was a very specific situation up in the Northern Territory, where the patient just up and left, and we had to
pull
it back and,
my goodness,
and give propofol. Yeah, that's not going to be happening to anyone. Most people, even if they're not English speaking and have any level of understanding, you know, they're so fearful that they don't move. You know, they know that something's. So that would be my kind of step by step progress. But just remember, in this exam, if you need to do a GA, you just have to, like, often the exam will be, you need to make a difficult decision in a weird context, or, you know, difficult context. You need to get to, if you think it's going to the GA, I quickly talk through all of my steps without too much pausing and waiting for the examiner. I go, look, stop, clarify, resedate with a few things, you know, reblock if necessary, and maybe run a very small dose of propofol. And if all of these are failing, because I'm now predicting what the examiner might ask me, I will then do a GA and just get ready for my monitoring drugs and equipment. I often practice, you know, that kind of smooth delivery, hopefully, to can keep going with the Viva or whatever the exam is.
It's a good point. And then they'll just sort of take you down the pathway that they want you to go down, right? They'll either point you down, the sedation worked, or no, you know, convert to GA, and then they'll have a grade 4 airway or something horrendously exciting. So look, would you do anything differently if this patient was an 18-year-old with myotonic dystrophy who was presenting for left-sided cataract surgery, say 110 kilos, BMI 32, and also anxious?
Yeah, so let's take the anxiety, and let's say that's we're going to do all the things that we talked about for anxiety. The BMI now is a bit of a concern, but I've done very, very large patients, and they, you know, you can always get them into a comfortable position. Let's say they have to be head up for whatever reason, BMI, difficulty breathing, some kind of fixed flexion thing. You can just tilt the head of the bed up and then lower the whole bed. And most surgeons can deal with it, even a little bit of angulation, with not too much issue. The next part of that question is the myotonic dystrophy. And I've got to say, so I would deal with this like any other rare condition. You know, absolutely look at my notes or look at the, you know, the last thing. And really, you're worried about the myotonia itself. Do they have spasms? Can they lie still? What's the degree of difficulty with them? You know, often they have other associated diseases, and it, you know, it could be that they have more frequent cataracts, which is the reason they're coming in, or they might have cardiovascular disease or OSA. And really, I'm really trying to have a conversation with the patient and their medical specialist potentially about what their needs are and what their problems are. But almost always, this can be done with regional anesthesia, providing all those other things aren't a problem. If for whatever reason had to go with a GA, you know, you want to avoid sucks in these patients. And again, there's so many random muscular disorders. I've got a table of just all the different ones and which ones avoid sucks and which ones don't, but I'm not going to be able to memorize that. I need to refer to these notes and really make a nuanced plan about this. But this very unlikely to happen in small day hospitals. So, you know, I'm just talking from logic and just kind of a reasonable approach. Most of us aren't working in I&E hospitals that specifically cater to complex eye surgery or complex patients having eye surgery. So it's just just as a full kind of disclosure, I do a lot of eyes, and often these are cataracts, some squint surgery, and some ocular plastics. And my experience with these other ones, literally, my sister is an ophthalmologist, and I asked her about these situations to just clarify a few things as well. And there is a bit of variability in the next few scenarios in what the surgeon might prefer as well. But generally, this is where I'm getting my information from.
Okay. Now, we've finished our procedure and we're preparing to take our 71-year-old female patient out to the recovery room. What can we expect postoperatively in terms of pain management and other special instructions for the patient having elective surgery like this?
The interesting is I rarely have anything to do with ophthalmology pain, post-op pain management, which is great. You know, the surgeon's rooms take care of a lot of this. Generally speaking, they'll get a bit of Panadol and a bit maybe Nurofen or something. Occasionally, one of my surgeons gives Diamox because they believe that whatever happened, the increase in eye pressure can cause pain. And in this experience, that's one of the things that we'll give in either one dose in recovery or for 24 hours before review for maybe a difficult operation. But literally, I went to my hospital, looked at multiple surgeons' notes, and all the notes were slightly different. But generally, you know, warn the patient they'll have a foreign body sensation. They'll get a script for, you know, a moisturizer like Celevisc and Predfort or Maxidex these days, or a steroid ointment. They will need glasses still for the first few days. Some get an appointment the next day or at some point in time, and they shouldn't drive to that appointment. You know, their eyes might not be settled yet. They might have double vision for 24 hours. They might have blurred central vision for 10 days. That's about 5% of people. And really, they get the information about if you get worsening pain, worsening redness, discharge, or poor vision, could be an infection, which is around the 1 in 1,000 chance. And definitely, you know, seek medical advice, go to hospital, contact the ophthalmologist if that occurs. And then there's a whole bunch of other things. I mean, kind of obvious things, you know, you don't, you know, get your eye wet for 24 hours, don't wash your hair with shampoo for 3 days, avoid makeup on the eyes. You can sleep with your head in any position, avoid alcohol for 24 hours after the operation. Don't be swimming in the first 2 weeks. Don't rub the eye, and always wash your hands prior to administering your drops. And no heavy lifting for 2 weeks, no strenuous exercise for a month. And probably need to wear sunglasses as well, just for the glare and the discomfort from that for the first month or so.
It's pretty straightforward, all things considered.
All
right. Well, let's pivot to another scenario. On your elective ophthalmic surgical list, you see a 14-year-old girl scheduled for strabismus surgery. The surgeon tells you he cannot remember any of the patient's history, except that she weighs approximately 45 kilos with a BMI of 20. How would you approach this situation?
Yeah, so almost all of these strabismus surgeries will be a general anaesthetic. And really, as soon as I see this, it's either a patient who's, you know, otherwise normal, idiopathic strabismus, or there's another disease associated with this. And if that's the case, it's often going to a more specialist center, and I don't expect to see that on my, you know, private list. So the first thing is there any kind of potential medical conditions, which could be a whole bunch of things from, you know, acquired ocular nerve palsies or myasthenia gravis. There's a whole list of things in one of these CEA-CCP articles.
Yes, we will link to that as well. We will link to that as
good
well.
Good old CEA-CCP.
Well, now it's BJA education.
It is, yes.
Yeah, that's right. So there's a whole bunch of things that can be associated. So absolutely, you know, clarify that, look for that. But then, you know, what is the most important thing about this surgery is the fact that when they're doing the surgery and they're putting traction on the muscles, you will almost always get this dramatic heart rate response. And so you're absolutely watching the heart rate, absolutely having ECG on, where some places don't in some operations. So absolutely have that. And it's such a regular thing that happens that I almost just decide to pre-treat with atropine or glycopyrrolate. Like in this young patient, you'd rather have their heart rate constantly above 80 to 100 rather than it going to the 60s and 50s. But you know that that's got a very short way to go before you're getting, you know, suddenly going in there. And why not just keep everything comfortable? They've got a GA, they can tolerate a heart rate. Just give them that preemptive atropine or glycopyrrolate. You'll absolutely be right.
Fair enough. So taking a step back, how would you actually anaesthetize this patient?
Yeah, if they're just otherwise
healthy 14-year-old, yeah.
Yeah. That's actually the easiest question ever. I'd give them a GA and probably run Teva. That's literally it.
Okay. Do you have a specific opioid choice? Do you like to give them a pre-med with midazolam? Like, can you walk us through the medications you would give?
I mean, literally, you could do anything. So I'd feel almost a bit odd telling people what I do because, you know, give fentanyl, don't give fentanyl. Midaz, sure. Propofol, give a decent dose, get them asleep, put an LMA down, run volatile if you like. I just don't have a good opinion on this. I do, worry about PONV. I'll give them fentanyl just because that's the common thing that's available. I will absolutely give them PONV prophylaxis, and I'll probably give them two agents and run Teva. Or if I'm not running Teva for whatever reason, I'll give them three agents and have stuff available afterwards. But I mainly, it's like a general anesthetic for any other LMA easy case. Just watch nausea, vomiting, watch the heart rate. And those are the points of difference I talk about.
Speaking of the heart rate, we have our patient asleep. They're stable. Surgeons are prepped and draped. And within a couple of minutes, the patient becomes profoundly bradycardic with a heart rate of 25 down from 76. The blood pressure cuff starts to inflate, but it just keeps cycling and you don't get a measurement. Now, this probably wouldn't happen to you because you've pre-treated with atropine or glyco. But say me giving the anaesthetic and I have been warned to do that. What would you do next?
Yeah, so absolutely, this is, you know, this could be devastating as a complication. Stop the surgery and then almost immediately resolve it. The blood pressure, you don't need to know what the blood pressure is. I just ignore it for now. I don't care that cycling. That's obviously just a delay because you're not getting enough beats of the heart. It should resolve, but I'd always give it at that point. I'd give atropine. And know that most of the time you're not having a fluid. Some of the time you may not be having fluid bags up. For these cases, I'd absolutely have a fluid bag running so I can easily get that medication flushed. And then, you know, once the heart rate gets to something reasonable and let's say 80 to 100, absolutely get the surgeons to start again. Now, the interesting thing, I've had a couple of, you know, vasovagals are common, bradycardias are common. The interesting thing I tell all of my trainees is that that number that you see on the heart rate, that's an average of the last whatever number of seconds your monitor's programmed to. So the surgeon will tell me, I'm now putting traction on the eye, I stop everything, I look at that ECG trace, and as soon as I see a lengthening, I don't care what the number says, I just go, stop, atropine, I'll never even see a bad number because it hasn't averaged out yet. So that's one of the big things I tell all my trainees during any kind of pneumoperitoneum or any other vaguely inducing procedure.
That's good.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, random off-script question. So this heart rate's down to 20. I know, scary. This heart rate's gone down to 25. At what point do you actually start doing chest compressions to help circulate the atropine? Do you have a threshold in your mind, or, you know, in a young person, do you just wait with the inevitability that, you know, once you've reduced that vagal stimulus, the heart rate will improve? Like, how do you approach this?
It's a really good question. And look, I'd say that you could think that this is the right thing to do is chest compression because, you know, heart rate's so low and that's what's needed. But I know in my experience of low heart rates, stop the stimulus, give a decent dose of atropine. Like if it's down to 20 or, you know, less than that, you might be absolutely giving the 1200 mics of atropine even and making sure it's flushed. It's always come back. So the extra potential harm of rib fractures on this patient and the fact that they're young, they're going to recover from this. I don't think I'd do chest compressions. Again, they may be it's hard to just say that statement in a podcast.
Yeah, of course.
Lots of caveats, but as a isolated temporary thing, I probably wouldn't do chest compressions. If it was asystole, absolutely, I'd do chest compressions, but down to 20, I know it's going to resolve.
Fair enough. So look, while we're here, can you briefly describe the ocular reflexes that we may potentially see in patients having eye surgery? We've already touched on one, but let's cover all of them.
Yeah, absolutely. The ocular cardiac reflex, that's the one you're going to see time and time again. Bradycardia following traction on your extra ocular muscles, especially the medial rectus. And, it can be reflex can be used, so, you know, to stop SVTs with eyeball massage, for example. You've got these afferent pathways via the occipital branch of the trigeminal nerve, the efferents are via the vagus, and the reflex is particularly active in children. So that's where you get this thing in squint surgery. It can be severe, may lead to asystole. And, you know, just imagine the situation as well, where not only do you have the traction happening, but you just happen to have a low blood pressure post-induction and a bit of bradycardia, and you give aramine. So now you've got this reflex, plus baroreceptor reflex. So just always being very aware of we've covered the treatment for that. The ocular respiratory reflex, so it's hypoventilation following traction on extraocular muscles. And again, you know, I've definitely not seen this in all the squint surgeries I've done, but, you know, apparently a decreased respiratory, decreased tidal volume or irregular ventilation that may occur and involves the same afferent pathways as the ocular cardiac reflex, but the efferents are via the respiratory centers. The heart rate may be unchanged in this. And avoid hypercapnia, which sensitizes that reflex. The ocular emetic reflex, so maybe the reason for increased incidence of vomiting following squint surgery, involves the ophthalmic division of the trigeminal nerve and vomiting center in the medulla, and decrease the incidence by blocking the afferent nerves by way of a block. But you also get ocular, like the pain in the eyeball due to high pressure can cause vomiting as well. So there is this thing that my sister was talking to me about a white eye blowout fracture. So in young kids, they get like this green stick fracture of the inferior bone, and the inferior rectus muscle then gets trapped in the fracture. So those patients can get a vasovagal, they can faint, vomit looking up. So that's a very specific kind of thing. But if you ever hear about a white eye blowout fracture in young kids, that's, you got to watch out for a few of these things.
There you go. So the surgeons have stopped tugging on the extraocular muscles. Everything's gone well. Surgery is progressing. Is there anything special you would do when waking this patient up?
Yeah, so I actually wouldn't do anything special. I'd make sure that the heart rate is normal. That's already resolved, right? No more traction. Mm. Make sure they've had the antiemetics. And then I would extubate as for any. So if, as a 14-year-old, I'd probably extubate normally for this. If I was in a private hospital as a practical thing, I'd absolutely extubate before they get to recovery just because there's only me there and no other staff members. And, would I do a deep extubation? Probably not. With an LMA, coughing is just not an issue like with an extubation of a tube. So I'd probably not necessarily need to go the left lateral deep extubation. If it was a younger kid, pre-teens, pre-adolescent, I think I would do left lateral deep extubation. And I just want them to wake up nice and slow with, hopefully with TEVA, and they just wake up nicely and don't have any emergence delirium as well.
And I suppose hand in hand with that, you need staff that are used to dealing with kids that have had a deep extubation when it comes, or removing the LMA when they're deep, so they don't stimulate the patient, cause a laryngospasm, and any series of problems that kind of follow on from there. So you want to have nice experienced staff in your PACU as well.
Yep, absolutely.
All right. Look, there were some really interesting scenarios we've just discussed, and we'd like to keep the conversation going, but we run out of time. Would you like to join us for another episode?
I think I would.
Oh, just as well. All right.
Fantastic. Well, that's all we have time for on today's episode of Deep Breaths. Don't forget to claim CPD if you are a provisional fellow or consultant. And if you like what you hear, please rate us on your favourite podcast platform.
You can always get in touch with us at deepbreathspod@gmail.com with suggestions, questions, or to say hi. Thanks for listening, and we hope you can join us next time on Deep Breaths.